Welcome to Power Play. Thanks for joining us. I'm Evan Solomon. On our program today, with the variant spreading so quickly, why are so many vaccines still sitting in provincial freezers?
Maybe some political folks are saying, oh, they have 1.3 million vaccines. What you don't tell the people, which I'm telling them right now, folks, we just got them 2 days ago. They just literally landed on our doorstep.
Okay, well, that's one version. The Prime Minister has another version. He said 10 million vaccines are in Canada, so why are less than 7 million Canadians vaccinated? Check this out.
Our government is delivering over 1 million doses a week to the provinces and territories. We're providing additional support to the provinces and territories for their pressing needs on vaccine rollout.
The math doesn't lie. Why are millions of vaccines still in freezers? Should the federal government do something to speed up the vaccination process? There's lots of questions, and the federal health minister, Patty Hajdu, will join us. We'll also hear from the Ontario Liberal leader, Stephen Del Duca, on the changes in that province. Plus, more school closings are harsh restrictions, and harsher ones inevitable. Look at this.
The numbers in the ICU is more than we had in the first and second wave at one time.
Schools in Toronto go online in a desperate effort to stop the spread of the variants, but the teachers need to get vaccinated as a priority. Do all essential workers? What needs to change? We're going to ask Dr. Lowe, the Chief Medical Officer of Health for the Peel region, one of the hardest hit areas in Ontario. We got lots on the program. We're going to look ahead to the NDP and the Liberal conventions as well. This is Power Play. Let's get to those players. There are millions more vaccines in Canada's arsenal, but are those vaccines moving quickly enough to get into your arms? Look, variants are making their way across the country, and ICUs are experiencing a surge. So do provinces need to pick up the pace? We're going to put that to the federal health minister, and she joins us now. Joining me now is the Health Minister of Canada, Patty Hajdu. Great to have you back on the program, Minister. Hope the family's well. Let me just start with this debate between vaccines supply and vaccine administered. You tweeted out that the government has provided 10 million vaccines to all the provinces and territory. Only 6.6 million have actually been administered to people. In Ontario, for example, as you say, the government's delivered more than 4 million vaccines, yet as of today, only 2.6 million have actually been administered. Are you concerned that the provinces are not rolling out the vaccines fast enough?
Well, look, I think it's important that vaccines get out the door as soon as possible. And I know that they are working to do that. And I'll just say this, if any province or territory is struggling with their own vaccination program, they should for sure let me know. We have the ability to help in a variety of different ways, including money, including human resources, including expertise. But certainly our expectation is, and I think Canadians' expectation, more importantly, Evan, is that people get vaccinated as soon as possible.
Okay, but I just want to do the math here, because this is important for people, because this is the thing. This is the main thing. Getting the vaccines, I get it. January, February, early March, federal responsibility. There was a scarcity. There was a drought. You guys took a lot of heat for it, and it was a legitimate question for people. Now you've got 10 million. You'd only promised 6 million, so it's a different story here. In Ontario, they only administered 73,000 doses yesterday. That's less than half of their own target of 150,000 a day. At that rate, 73,000, it would take them close to 20 days to get rid of the current supply. And that doesn't count the millions of vaccines that are set to arrive this week. Doesn't that concern you?
Well, listen, what I'll say, Evan, is that Canadians have sacrificed a tremendous amount over the last year and a half. It's been a terrible year for so many Canadians, so difficult on so many levels. And what provinces and territories do next will determine how much more Canadians have to sacrifice. We know that vaccines are a very important tool in fighting this pandemic. They will continue to arrive millions week over week. And it's really important, I think, that Canadians have an opportunity to be able to see what's happening in their own province and territory week to week. And importantly, how to make sure they have the information they need to plan their own vaccination or their family members' vaccination.
But, Minister, the only reason I'm pressing on this is, you know, when you got tension between the federal government and the province on something so essential, that confusion can cause distrust. Like Premier Ford said, I saw the tweet. He's talking about your tweets. States. I saw the tweet from the federal minister, Hajdu. Oh, we have 1.3 million in the freezers. He says, we just got those. We literally got them a few days ago. So before that, we were, quote, running out and will continue to run out. Is that a problem? Is Ontario going to run out? Is, as he said, just I want to know what your response is to that.
Well, listen, I can't speak to what his plans are over the next several weeks to accelerate vaccination, but I can reassure the premier, as I have been, that he will continue to get millions of doses, hundreds of thousands of doses in Ontario, millions of doses into the country week over week. And it's very important that Canadians, as I said, have a line of sight on what their province right. has received and what has been administered, and importantly, how they get more information about the plan. I think over the weekend, we heard a lot of distress around a variety of different vulnerable populations that haven't been vaccinated, concerns around equity, concerns around specific plans around phase two for Ontario's vaccination plan. And now we've concisely put it all together for people to be able to check out their own province and territory and ask questions if they have them.
So the Prime Minister today said the federal government might be able to help. The NDP leader, Jagmeet Singh, says even though this is not federal jurisdiction, it's clearly provincial jurisdiction, it's federal responsibility to get vaccines into people's arms. And I know the Prime Minister speaking to Premier Ford later tonight. How exactly could the federal government help? Is there if a province makes a request for federal help, hey, we need help rolling out the vaccine, does your government already have a plug-and-play, out-of-the-box solution to say, yeah, we can, here it is, we're going to send these military people, these doctors, here's a kit that you can set up to boost your vaccine rates immediately?
Since the beginning of the pandemic, we've been putting together what we call the Rapid Response Program, and it's been utilized across the country by provinces and territories for a variety of things. So, for example, the Windsor-Essex outbreak that went on for some time, we were able to deploy expertise, Red Cross workers, money for isolation housing, and we've been there in similar fashion for other provinces
but
across
for vaccines,
the country.
I'm just talking specifically for a vaccine.
And yes, Evan, we would have the capacity to put together support for provinces and territories to be able to help them if they were struggling in any aspect of delivery. And of course, those are conversations that have to be done with provinces and territories because they have the responsibility and the jurisdictional right to provide health care in their own jurisdictions.
Today, Conservative leader Erin O'Toole had a press conference calling for a public inquiry into the pandemic response. Things he cited: late border closing, lack of vaccine supply early on, the fact that the lack of supply has led to the fact that we've had to go off-label, in other words, not spread, as Pfizer said, 28 days between doses, or Moderna 21 days, but up to 4 months. He wants your government to appoint a special monitor within the Office of the Auditor General to track the response in real time. Would you support a public inquiry? Would you support this, quote, special monitor?
Well, listen, I will say this. We have always said that this country, like all countries, will need to do a post-pandemic review. Of course it should be open. Of course it should be transparent and public. Of course it should include provinces and territories' response along with the federal government. The whole country needs to take a look after we're through this crisis about how we've responded from the federal government perspective, from provincial and territorial perspectives, and how we can protect our country better the next time we face a global threat together.
Okay, so you would support an independent inquiry of some sort?
Like I've said, the Prime Minister has been clear, I've been clear, there will be a time for a full and thorough review. Of course, it should be public and transparent. But we do have to focus on getting through this health crisis now and look at, I think, every country should do this because we clearly know that all countries have a lot to learn.
Right. That recent report from the Auditor General who was on the show concluded that the Public Health Agency of Canada underestimated the impact of COVID, that the federal government didn't properly share information with provinces and territory, that the early warning system, the Global Public Health Intelligence Network, was essentially unplugged. Would you support the idea that is now being put forward that the global information warning system should be independent, run with the WHO, and funded outside of partisanship? Is that something you'd support?
certainly open to any options to strengthen our public health information network, but also our Public Health Agency of Canada. And I've been very clear throughout the pandemic that, you know, what we need to focus on is actual public health and understand that investment in prevention and protection is, in fact, wise investment. And that's been a hard thing, I think, for countries around the world to understand that it's not just health care. It is the protection and prevention, which is in the jurisdiction of public health.
Okay, last question. Just as you and I are speaking, President Joe Biden has just finished announcing that the U.S. is on track to deliver 200 million vaccinations in his first 100 days of office. He cited doing 4 million a day. How do you tell Canadians who are, you know, obviously watching American television, these are our closest neighbors, to wait so long for a shot? You know, there's so much pent-up frustration. You gotta, why should Canadians be satisfied with Canada's poor vaccine performance next to the US or even the UK? Are you asking Canadians to accept essentially mediocrity when it comes to the vaccine rollout?
Well, I think this ties into your earlier question, Evan, in terms of what kind of foundation needs to exist within Canada to protect us against global health threats. And indeed, we know that the biomanufacturing sector in Canada, you know, has been very sparse, I will say, over the last decade or two. We know that we can do more. And that's why Minister Champagne and I made the announcement in Toronto last week about investing in attracting manufacturers of vaccines, attracting people in the biomanufacturing sector, and supporting research and scientists to develop their careers here in Canada. This is going to be an important, I think, learning for our country and legacy, hopefully, of the pandemic, is that Canada will be much more self-sufficient going into the next global public health emergency.
It's been an expensive lesson and a tragic one. Minister Haidu, I always appreciate you joining us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Evan. Take care.
Okay, so as the situation across the country is getting worse, I want to take you now to Montreal, where Premier François Legault is providing an update on new restrictions in Quebec. Check this out.
We wish to bring new measures that are really preventive. There is no one that can say with certainty where we'll be in a week or two, but we really wish to act in a preventive way by adding measures and restrictions in red zones and orange zones. Public health is telling us that the places that worry them the most are the schools, sports, places of worship, homes. And so we've tried to look at the measures that should be set. Of course, I've often repeated it and I'm going to continue repeating it. The last place where we want to act are schools, because we want as much as possible for children to stay in school. It's important for their learning. It's also important for their social lives, their mental health. But at the same time, we have to look at what can be done as far as compromises are concerned. So in red zones, the red zones, well, we have our four new regions, so the National Capital Area, the Outaouais, the Lower St. Lawrence, and Chaudière-Appalaches. And we also have the regions that were already red, that is Montreal, Laval, Laurentians, Lanaudière, and the Montérégie. So I'm announcing that in those red zones, as of Monday next, we are going to be coming back to alternates in secondary 3, 4, and 5. That means that students are going to go to school one day out of two. Also, public health is asking us to cancel extracurricular activities. So as of Monday next, and as of Thursday of this week, we're also going to limit sports activities held inside. We are going to be closing down gyms in red zones, and we're going to be limiting the number of people in places of worship to 25. Still in red zones, I'm talking about here. And maybe a comment on the secondary 3, 4, and 5 students. Of course, I expect that certain people are going to tell us, well, last week or the previous week, you were saying the opposite. Well, listen, I prefer that public health adjusts itself for the health of Quebecers rather than at all price defend a position because it is the position that had been chosen last week. So I find it to a certain extent even very courageous on the part of public health to tell us, well, listen, last week we were saying that it was possible to send secondary 3, 4, and 5 students back to school full-time. This week we think it's too risky, and at the same time it is a compromise because those teenagers, because in those years they're teenagers, they'll still be able to go to school one day out of two. In orange zones now, public health is giving us a series of recommendations that we're following. Amongst others, there are two that are important. We are going to be making masks mandatory even in primary schools in the first years. I know that certain parents were worried of the impact in young children, but I can tell you that we already are doing it in red zones, and it's going very well. The children are a lot more able to adapt themselves than what we thought. As far as places of worship are concerned, in orange zones, it's going to go from 250 down to 100. And that's where we'll stop for the time being. For the time being. There is, however, another measure that is important. It's to remind everybody of what is happening in people's homes. When we changed the curfew from 8 p.m. to 9:30 p.m., we saw a very significant increase of gatherings in people's homes, as if because the curfew was at 9:30 p.m. rather than 8 p.m., it was now allowed to go visit people at their friends or family's homes. That is still forbidden. And when we look at last week that ended on Sunday, police officers in Quebec gave 3 times more tickets for people gathering illegally in their homes and residences in total. They gave two times more tickets, but if we just look at the part of the fines, in homes it's 3 times more. And the police officers are going to be continuing to be very strict on what is happening in homes. Now, we played around, to tell you the truth. We juggled with the idea of bringing the curfew back to 8 p.m. in all red zones. But at the same time, public health is telling us where there's a lot of people, workers, first of all, who are working a little later. There are also people with the spring coming up who want to go walk around. However, I want to tell you that we will not hesitate. If there is, for example, an increase in the number of cases over the next few days in Montreal, we are going to bring the curfew back down to 8 p.m. I just want people to understand. We're saying we're not changing it today, but we're not excluding that possibility. We are following that very closely from day to day. A few days ago, also, public health, the director of public health and the minister for health sent new guidelines to regional public health authorities in order to say, don't wait. When there's a gym or a business or a store that does not respect the guidelines, close them down. It's urgent, and we cannot wait for those cases to multiply themselves. And perhaps just to say, to end with, for the time being, and I am saying for the time being, the situation is under control. I think that the decisions that we've made rapidly make it that right now, even in intensive care units, the situation is under control. However, we are keeping a very close eye on it from 1 hour to the next, and we will not hesitate in acting very quickly if there's an increase in the number of cases in certain regions, even if there is not yet any increase in the number of hospitalizations. So we can see that the month of April is truly going to be a critical, crucial month. I know that, I don't know if it's just in Quebec that we say that, but when we say, you know, in April, don't pretend as if it's spring. We can see that April is going to be the month of every danger. So we have to really concentrate in the month of April.
All right, there's Premier Legault basically saying April's going to be a dangerous month. Grades 9, 10, 11 in red zones are going to alternate. The students are going to go on every second day they're going to go because it's too risky to put everybody back in school. And some of the red zones, like in Montreal and those areas, houses of worship are going to go down to 25. Gyms are closed. Sports are closed. So some new restrictions in Quebec, new restrictions also in other hot zones like Toronto. They just shut down their schools. And coming up next, we're going to dig into that as well. What needs to change in that province and other provinces to stop the spread? Do teachers need to be a priority on the vaccine? We're going to get the latest developments from Colin DeMello at Queen's Park, and the Liberal leader of Ontario, Stephen Del Duca, is going to drop by as well. Stay right here with Power Play.
Of course, provinces and territories are going to be administering vaccines as they get them. Our expectation is that they work as diligently as possible to get them out as quickly as possible. I think that's what Canadians' expectations are.
Okay, so that's Patty Heide, the Minister of Health. She was just on this program. She was responding to a question about how quickly the federal government expects the provinces to roll out vaccines because, as you know, there's been ongoing bickering between the federal government and the provinces over who's dropping the ball when it comes to vaccine acquisition or vaccine administration. The province is saying the federal government isn't getting enough vaccines. Fact, that was true January, February. Now, at the end of March, the promise was 6 million vaccines. The federal government has delivered 10 million, so they've over-delivered on that now. The federal government is arguing that the provinces are sitting on millions of doses in freezers. They say, for example, they've delivered 10 million doses and under 7 million have been actually put in the arms. The math is not partisan. You know, millions of vaccines are still in freezers. So what's going on here? To dig down what's going on in the situation in Ontario, because the Prime Minister is going to be speaking to the Premier of Ontario in just a few hours, we are joined by CTV News Queen's Park Bureau Chief Colin DeMello. Colin, great to have you back on the program. All right, can you just lay out the math here? I know the Federal Health Minister was just on the show saying Ontario's got 4 million. Ontario's only delivered and vaccinated 2.6 million. But Doug Ford says, oh, that 1.5 million have just arrived, so don't blame us. What do you say about that?
Yeah, well, you know, I think the province, to a degree, is trying to have its cake and eat it too, right? They consistently defer to the federal government to ask for more vaccines. But the fact of the matter is, when Ontario receives the vaccines, it is not, at least according to the numbers we see every day, getting them out in an expedited manner. So to your point, the province has so far received 4 million vaccines. It has so far administered 2.6 million vaccines. There are about 1.4 million of a variety of them that have yet to be administered. The province says it takes a couple of days. The Pfizer is delivered straight from the federal government to the hospital sites, as an example, where they will be administered. Moderna and AstraZeneca, they go to a central depot and then are then distributed to pharmacies, primary care facilities, and other local public health units. So that transportation takes a bit of time. They also say, you know, in some cases, some public health units are moving at a rapid pace. So some public health units, as an example, every single dose that they're going to get allocated to them is spoken for. They have an appointment. Some others, like Toronto, they have a wealth of open appointments. And so then they go to, you know, an outreach team. And that, you know, in itself isn't necessarily fast because you've got to identify the people and then convince them to get to the vaccination site. So they're, you know, providing all these explanations. But I think to a lot of people, it says, well, it clearly seems like you can't get them out fast enough. So why is this consistent narrative there that Ontario doesn't have enough? Those two don't seem to mesh.
Yeah, I mean, outside of politics, the target's 150,000 a day. They're doing on average 73,000, not even half the target. That's the math. That's not spin. The province also moved up vaccinating essential workers, Colin, who can't work from home from June to mid-May. What does that tell you? And is this part of what we could see, a total transformation to move from an age-based vaccination process to a hot zone exposure-based vaccination strategy?
Well, the province has just started phase two of its campaign, and it specifically deals with some of those things, right? They're going to be going to hotspot communities where COVID-19 is raging to really target people there who are 50 plus. They're saying anyone in the province now who's 60 plus can sign up to go get a vaccine. But it is those essential workers who really are the priority for some cities like, you know, in Peel region as an example, right? They're seeing a disproportionate number of essential workers in factories and the food processing industry, warehousing, and distribution. They're seeing a number of cases originating from there. They're going into the community and, you know, further spreading COVID-19. So they're asking not for mid-May. They're asking for an immediate strategy to kind of start targeting those workers in those workplaces. Now, the province says, listen, we've made appointments. So now if we start, you know, reallocating those vaccines, we're going to have to cancel appointments. And they don't want to necessarily put elderly people at a position where they don't have a vaccine, they get the virus, and we see mortality rates go up. So, you know, there are two different priorities here for some mayors who are seeing, you know, the burning flames, and it's getting larger. But the province isn't necessarily moving that essential services category up further. So some people are going to be unhappy about that.
Right. Yeah, well, that's the nature of a changing battle. Colin DeMello, we're watching for further restrictions maybe tomorrow in the province where you live. Colin DeMello, our CTV News Queen's Park Bureau Chief, great to have you on the program. I want to bring in the Liberal leader in Ontario. Again, we did ask for representatives of the government to join us. Stephen Del Duca, though, is available. He's a Liberal leader in that province. Sir, what do you make about, first of all, the rollout strategy? Doug Ford saying, you know, I can't get these out of the freezers fast enough, even though there's almost 1.5 million still in freezers. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells me, as you said earlier, the numbers don't lie. And it tells me that despite the fact that Doug Ford and his team have known now for weeks, maybe even months, that we would arrive in a situation where we had this much supply of the vaccines, that they haven't been ready, that they have not been competent enough to manage the situation so that we are getting the vaccines out of the fridges and into people's arms, which is what everybody wants to see.
What about the vaccine strategy? I was just talking about this with Colin DeMello. Do you believe that it should switch from essentially an age-based? I know there's now some postal codes are getting it, and obviously there's going to be a move for some essential workers to move up the timeline. Do you believe there should be a more dramatic shift to essential workers, grocery store folks, transit officials, drivers, and teachers? Should they be getting the vaccine on a priority list? I think I got a frozen. Hang on there. What we've got here is what we call the COVID technical difficulty, and look at that, we've resolved it. All right, I think you heard the question, but Mr. Del Duca, should we vaccinate teachers as a priority and other essential workers?
Yeah, I absolutely do believe that we should. So whether we're talking about teachers, the other education workers we have on the front lines, grocery store workers, like anybody out there who comes into regular direct contact, especially in hot zones like Toronto, Peel, York, and elsewhere, definitely needs to be moved up in the prioritization of vaccines. People have been calling on this for many weeks now. If your house is on fire, you don't use the water where the flames aren't burning. You use it where the flames are burning, where they're hottest. And Doug Ford has just been so stubborn on this one. It's like paid sick leave. He's refused to move on this to help those workers who need the help the most and help all of us flatten the curve and get through this third wave.
Yeah, and you want these workers to be, teachers to be, what, vaccinated over the April break?
Yeah, absolutely. I've called for a vaccine blitz. We know that starting next week that teachers across the province and other education workers will have that April break, as we're now calling it. There's nothing to stop Doug Ford from moving them up in the queue to make sure that our classrooms, our schools, more importantly, our kids remain safe. And look, Evan, the bottom line is I don't think people expect perfection from any political leader, but they do expect basic competence. Just today, while Doug Ford was speaking and claiming Ontario schools are safe, Toronto joined Peel and others to say, starting tomorrow, Toronto schools will be closed. So it makes no sense. I don't think Doug Ford has control of the situation. I don't think he has a competent plan to get us through the rest of the second wave, a third wave, and to get the vaccine.
Should there be a stay-at-home order? I'm going to talk to Dr. Lowe from the Peel region in a minute, but do you believe there should be a sort of deeper restrictions and a province-wide stay-at-home order?
Yeah, I favored the regional approach all the way from the very beginning last summer and into the fall. I'm okay with the regional approach. I'd want to hear from medical officers of health like Dr. Lowe and others. But here's the thing that was really stark for me today. Last Thursday, Doug Ford announced that shopping malls in this province could remain open. Then we saw over the course of the weekend that parking lots in those malls were jam-packed with people in unsafe ways. And today, Doug Ford blamed people for going to shopping malls that he allowed to stay open. Like, this was a shock to him. That's not the basic level of competence that we need in a premier at this critical moment.
All right. Listen, this is a critical moment. Stephen Del Duca, great to have you on the program. I appreciate your perspective at this time. Thanks.
Thank you, Evan. Take care.
You take care as well. Before we go, I got some other news you need to know right now. Iran has indicted 10 officials in relation to the Ukrainian passenger plane they shot down last year. 176 people died in that shoot down. More than 100 of them had ties to Canada, including 55 Canadian citizens. This announcement comes after Iran faced international criticism last month after releasing a bogus final report into the investigation that failed to provide evidence the flight was shot down by mistake. Meantime, the trial of the former Minneapolis police officer, Derek Chauvin, is hearing from expert witnesses today about police training and the use of force. The court heard a use of force instructor about techniques used by police, including unconscious neck restraint. The court heard those techniques are only authorized in cases of active aggression. Chauvin completed use of force training back in 2018. He's charged with murder and manslaughter in the death of George Floyd. And a virtual tribute being held today to remember the 16 members of the Humboldt Broncos hockey team who died and the 13 others injured in that tragic bus crash 3 years ago, April 6, 2018. The ceremony will be live streamed on Facebook. Church bells will toll across the city at 4:50 p.m. local time, the approximate time of the crash. Coming up, the third wave is crashing down on Canada, forcing some doctors to call for tougher restrictions. What's the best game plan right now? We'll find out from Dr. Lowe. He's in the hot zone. He joins us next.
This is moving day by day, by hour by hour. I think we made a massive move last week by basically shutting down the entire province. That was huge, shutting down thousands and thousands of business that I hate doing. But we're going to have further restrictions moving forward very, very quickly. And again, we have to focus on where we see the problem. Three regions, York, Peel, and Toronto, represent 60% of the COVID cases.
More restrictions coming in Ontario as three of Ontario's top doctors calling on the province to impose a stay-at-home order. Will the Ontario Premier answer the call? As you just saw, he says he's going to put that discussion off until tomorrow, but something's coming. Some Ontario health units are already starting to take things into their own hands. Peel Region announced they're moving in-person schooling online. The Niagara Health Region has already started vaccinating education workers and teachers. They think that's a priority. So is the third wave forcing regions to strike out on their own? Are governments moving too slowly to respond to the rapid new threat posed by the variants? Let's bring in the press gallery to weigh in on all that. Bob Fife, the Ottawa Bureau Chief of the Globe and Mail, joins us. Our friend Tonda McCharles, political reporter with the Toronto Star, is here. And our special guest today is Dr. Lowe, the Chief Medical Officer of Health for the Peel Region. Good to have all three of you here, Dr. Lowe. We always thank you for your incredible frontline work. Your region announced you're closing in-school learning. You sent a letter alongside your colleagues in Ottawa and Toronto to the Chief Medical Health Officer to impose more restrictions. If I put it into your hands right now, what would you need to see happening right now?
You know, I think it's very clear that we're seeing a third wave significantly impact, not just the large populous urban areas of Ontario, but really the province as a whole. With the restrictions that were loosened back in February, the variants of concern have really, ramped up and essentially overtaken our vaccination efforts. At this point in time, ideally, we'd want to see some sort of measures that really return to what we were seeing with the first wave, where at least just for the next 2 to 4 weeks, we try to get everybody and anybody as much as possible to stay home, to break the chains of transmission, really bring this quickly under control so that we can actually ensure that our vaccination efforts can catch up and then permanently have us exit from this altogether.
Yeah, Bob, when you hear Dr. Lowe talk about that, it's just not happening, you know. People are, malls are still open, and then you've got, people are going to school in certain areas. ICUs are filling up with younger people. Does that age-based strategy that has been in effect, are governments too slow to change that given the new threats?
Well, I think the governments, particularly in Ontario, I can't speak for other provinces, have been sending very mixed messages. They are strict at one point and then they loosen up, or they give the mixed messages that we had from the premier last week where, we can go to shopping malls, and then when the shopping malls are full, he gets mad because people are in shopping malls. Well, he's allowed them to be in shopping malls. My big concern here, and I'd be interested in what Dr. Lowe has to say, is that I'm worried that even if you have a stay-at-home order, people are not going to do that anymore. I think people are getting really fed up, even though the variants are spreading like wildfire and it's getting much more dangerous. I worry that people, with all the mixed messages we have from government and the isolation of over a year, that people are just getting fed up and they're not going to obey these kind of stay-at-home orders.
Yeah, I'll get back to you, Dr. Lowe, on that. But, Tonda, I want you to just weigh in on the mixed messages, the slow rollout of vaccines. There's a lot of pent-up frustration, clearly.
Oh, for sure there is. And look, there have been mixed messages throughout this pandemic, haven't there? We've heard mixed messaging initially on things like masks, initially on things like border restrictions, and on it goes. I do have, I guess, some sympathy for the public decision makers trying to figure out a way to break through the COVID fatigue, because it doesn't seem like they have a grip on how to communicate with their public. I mean, even as Doug Ford sort of first won people over with what seemed to be sort of a charming sincerity, now he's expressing frustration at their inability to follow his line of thinking. But frankly, we don't know what we're supposed to do in many places where we don't have, for example, the caseload that they have in Peel or Toronto. So, look, I have sympathy for them, but it doesn't help the public to understand. And look, business owners, they're so frustrated right now. I talked to one business owner late last week around the closures who just said, what is going on? Like, this open, close is not helping anyone. Yeah. And my staff are on the front lines here. And so we are at risk. So I just, none of it's working for anybody.
Yeah, Dr. Lowe, let me just show you that you've all mentioned this. So I'll just might as well show our viewers a clip, because Doug Ford today said going to the mall was not essential. Don't go. But they remained open. Check out this.
I'm sorry, but going to the malls is not essential. What's essential is going to buy food, going to buy medicine out of the pharmacies, and getting your vaccines.
So the premier says don't go to the mall, doctor, but the malls are open. What's your take on all this and just refracting through what Bob Fyfe said about trust?
Yeah, I think he and the premier and certainly all of our decision makers have had navigated a pretty unprecedented crisis. And I can understand that it's very difficult, especially with, the constant moves and waves. We are living essentially a human health emergency at this point in time. But I think it really speaks to the need to start to, at least as I penned in the letter, we need to look at taking decisive action now. We know, for example, that our ICUs are almost at capacity. In the region of Peel, if we weren't able to transfer people out of our hospitals, we'd be into the field units. We'd be into a situation where we're far over capacity. And a lot of young, really severe patients coming in and staying for longer. And so I think, to the extent that the first wave and what we saw with the first wave was really an ability to stay home and out of fear, I do recognize there is a lot lot of fatigue, a lot of frustration. The message needs to turn to one, especially in this third wave, of let's do it again, but this time because it's the last time we'll have to do it. If we do this right, we've seen Israel and the UK, they managed to just say, stay home, we'll stay home hard, we'll get people vaccinated through it, and then we'll get to the coverage. And then when that magical threshold comes, then we'll start to reopen gradually and finally get out of this for good.
I got a minute here, Bob, but you know, you're finding out there's millions of vaccines still in freezers. Like, after months of waiting to get them, they've arrived. They ain't in people's arms. What do you make of that?
Well, no, that is definitely a problem. And all the health professionals are saying that's fine, we've got these vaccines, but how are they being properly distributed? They have to get to the factory floors. Do we should be using mobile clinics to do that? We do have to get them into teachers. We have to get into poorer areas where COVID is a much more severe problem than it is in some other areas. I know that doesn't fit well with a lot of people because everybody wants to have the vaccine. But there doesn't seem to have been much serious thought about when these millions of doses arrive, how do we distribute it to the hotspots? And there, as far as I can see, not a lot of thinking done on that.
Yeah, Tanya, you just got about 10 seconds on that. And you want to just weigh in?
Well, look, we've heard that they were going to get mobile clinics up and running. They were going to go into communities where they needed to get jabs in people's arms. But the numbers tell a story. They tell a different story. That hasn't happened.
All right. I got to leave that there. Dr. Lowe, I really appreciate your work. Good luck. I know in your region, lots of healthcare workers, lots of people suffering. And so we're watching your region closely. Thanks for your work. Tanya and Bob are going to stick around because we're heading into a week of political conventions. Will election prep dominate the debates at the Liberal and the NDP conventions? We'll return to dig into that in a minute. Stay with us. Welcome back to Power Play. So the red and the orange clans are gathering. The Liberals and the NDP are both hosting their policy conventions this week, just as the Conservatives did a few weeks ago. What should you pay attention to this week? What are their internal debates about policy reveal about their potential election platforms? Let's bring back the press gallery. Joining us is the Globe and Mail Ottawa Bureau Chief, Bob Fyfe, and the senior reporter with the Toronto Star, Tanya McCharles. Tanya, I'll start with you. What are you watching for first at the Liberal Policy Convention?
Well, look, I think that the first thing to keep in mind is that the bar is really low. First off, all they've got to do is do better than the Conservatives did a couple of weeks ago, right? I mean, that just blew up in O'Toole's face. I don't see, I'm flicking through the resolutions here, and I don't see anything that's going to blow up in Justin Trudeau's face. So already, you know, he's already won the first day, shall we say, of the convention. Look, I think that all eyes will be on at least, you know, the star appearance of Mark Carney, the once upon a time dream finance minister for the Liberals who bailed out of politics last summer. He's going to appear. He's going to rag on about his great book on economics and values. And, you know, we're going to see what kind of maybe political chops he has in front of a crowd. It's too bad it's not really in front of a real crowd, because then you do get a sense of whether this guy can control a room, but this is going to be virtual. So look, I'm looking at things like that. I'm trying to figure out a bit the tone that the Liberals are going into the next election with. I think that you don't get the platform from the grassroots resolutions, but you get a sense of unity behind the leader for sure, and the rah-rah energy of the party for an election. But what you really want to get a sense of at these things is, to what extent has Trudeau really still got them all united behind him? Is there any grumbling? And all that's really hard to do at a virtual convention.
Yeah. You said the bar is low. There's no bar. It's virtual.
There's
and the
no bar
is probably the most important thing at any convention. Bob, what do you expect?
That's right.
Well, you know, we're in very turbulent times. The economy is in trouble because of COVID. Everybody's concerned about when this pandemic is going to get over and how we're going to adjust to life after. And the Liberals have been very wise, I think, in showcasing Mark Carney, who was not only a Bank of Canada governor here, but Bank of England governor. He is a real star, and I think he's a reassuring presence to people. And also showboating Chrystia Freeland, the finance minister, just the week before, or almost a week before the budget, is also a really smart move on the Liberals' behalf. I think they're trying to send a message of stability, that we know what we're doing, and we're going to come out of this okay. They also have some smart young Democrats who are part of the Biden win, which will which the rank and file of the party will appreciate. So, and to Tonda's point, this is going to be quite a contrast from what turned out to be a disaster for the Conservatives at their convention. So I think the Liberals are looking pretty good going into this weekend. It depends on what Trudeau says on Saturday in his speech when he finishes up to the rank and file. Mm. We'll see what he has to say. Although he tends anyway to talk in talking points. You never get much from him.
I was going to say you have higher expectations than I do, Bob, for that speech, because I haven't heard Trudeau give a barn burner really in well over a year and a half. I'm going back even to the last election campaign, which in its own first week kind of melted down into a disaster for Trudeau. So, look, it would be great to hear a barn burner speech from him, but I don't expect that.
Yeah, I think it'll be all talking.
What about Jagmeet Singh's got the NDP's got their convention. What do you expect to hear from Jagmeet Singh?
Well, Jagmeet Singh, I think, is in a completely different position. Like, he has got the ability to say to his troops that we've gotten some gains here and stick with me and whatnot. He has a little bit of a different, issue to manage, shall we say, in his party, because oftentimes the grassroots of the NDP are more at odds with their leader on a bunch of things. We saw what happened to Mulcahy, you know, he got basically deep-sixed at a convention before. So it's possible that there are pockets of grumblers about why isn't the NDP in better position now, you know, even though they have succeeded in winning some gains for Canadians in the pandemic, like the sick leave stuff, like enriched benefits for Canadians. But I think there's a possibility that things can bubble up for them on certain resolutions, often involving Israel, for example, and Palestine and that kind of thing. But I think at the end of that convention, you'll see that Singh is at least doing better than Mulcair did, for example, in Edmonton when he was knifed in the back. Nobody wants to knife Jagmeet Singh in the back right now. They want him to gain more seats in the next campaign. So I think they'll put up a front of unity.
Yeah, I think Mulcair was also knifed in the front in that convention. Bob, what do you expect from the NDP?
Well, Jagmeet Singh is going into this convention with pretty high favorability. Polls are showing Canadians quite like him. He's got to come out of this convention with some policies that people can relate to. And I think he will want to talk about a universal basic income, high quality care for our seniors, canceling student debt, which I think is something that will be positive for young people. He's just got to be careful of the crazies in the party that want to, you know, pass motions to not to tear down every memorial to Sir John A. Macdonald, to get rid of the armed forces and all of those sort of crazy stuff and the Palestinian Israeli stuff, which can really be wounding to them. But on the whole, I think we never get great expectations out of NDP conventions anyway. If he can come out with a positive view, I think he'll be fine heading into the election campaign.
Yeah, his likability scores are up. I just would mention that as the Liberals and the NDP are holding their conventions, there is what used to be called the Manning Center policy convention or meeting for Conservatives. And Stephen Harper will be speaking, and the former British Prime Minister David Cameron will be speaking. So they might grab some headlines while the NDP and the Liberals are trying to grab theirs. So, man, if anyone thought there was no election coming, sometime it's coming because they're all getting ready. I got to leave it there, though. Bob and Tonda, this is like my dream political dinner party here. Tonda and Bob, just listen to you two all day. Thanks so much, Chef, for joining us. That's fantastic. And thank all of you for joining us on Politics. Well, maybe we do a podcast with these guys. You can talk to them for hours. We'll be back here in 23 short hours. Thanks for watching. If it's safe, and stay safe, hug your loved ones. We'll see you back here tomorrow.